We are starting our summer series on the Beatitudes. And so Chris last week generally introduced them. And so tonight we're going to be looking at the first one, Blessed are the poor and realize their needs for him, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. And so this is found in Matthew 5. And so you can flip open if you want, but that's pretty much our text for tonight. We can keep reading it periodically to kind of keep us focused. But as we begin, I want to just start with a bit of a metaphor and frame some of this in terms of thinking about boxes. And boxes, I think, have sometimes come to represent ideas or thoughts that they kind of create frameworks, they categorize. Sometimes we use them to give meaning, to explain purpose or existence. And maybe if you want to use a broader term, they kind of form what we sometimes refer to as a worldview. And these boxes then become the norm, what's normal, the status quo, and what we might think personally is true or possible or right. And so in that sense, we begin to operate our lives in the confines of that box, order our lives around the framework. And then from time to time, we have these people who we talk about thinking outside of the box, that they come along and they kind of seem to stir things up. And sometimes we actually really are drawn to these kind of people. But at another level, it can be frightening because it shakes our foundations, our security. We say things like, we've never done that before. And just as we say that, it's kind of like the lid comes snapping down on our box. And sometimes I think, personally in my own life, that change can be a difficult process evolving can be a difficult process because it means that I have to open up my box and allow possibility of something bigger than my own mind, my own thinking. And so at the same time, as I mentioned, these people who come along and they think outside the box. And maybe we admire them at some level, but what they do is they begin to force us to examine the constructs of our own boxes and showing us something better or fresh, but leaving it for us to try and wrestle with. But I think in general, it's the nature of humanity to have everything safely packaged down, nailed down, explained, and safely locked tight in a box because it gives us security, preserves what we think is a way of preserving our identity. It threatens us to have to admit that something might be bigger than ourselves or something might be bigger than our own ideas, something greater than us, or someone has a better idea than us. And when those moments come up, sometimes it subtly erodes our self-confidence. Like how sometimes it feels when you're navigating a highway on a moonless, foggy night. Or if you're like me, walking around in a dark basement and you begin to hear noises and you start to get a little bit sketched out. It can be unsettling. And so in the end, we create these boxes, we use these boxes to make us feel safe, to make us feel good. We see them as a way to protect ourselves, to be comfortable. So you may be wondering why exactly I'm talking about boxes this way, but I want to use this metaphor now to think in the context of Jesus arriving on the scene and beginning to see what it would be like for him and what were the different kind of competing boxes or worldviews that were present. And I want to just give a quick overview of how the people of Israel got to where they were when Jesus came on the scene. If you remember, through Abraham, this race was formed, and they became this group that eventually was, through famine and through, I think, God's working at some levels, moved to Egypt as a way to be fed under the rule of Joseph. And then as they began to multiply, the Egyptians got nervous and they put them into slavery. And Moses came on the scene, was given the task to lead these people out of slavery. So he led them out to the wilderness and they were going to be led into this promised land. Some of them got nervous, second-guessed some of these ideas that God was giving them. And so as a punishment, they had to wander around in the desert for 40 years. Then Joshua took over from Moses, and he's the one who led them into the promised land and began to divide up the land. There were 12 tribes. And at that time, they worked kind of as this general tribal kind of way, where you'll see in as you read through the story in the Old Testament that the judges would come on, and they kind of gave direction to the people, kind of at some level spoke to the people on behalf of God. And then you see this transition where Samuel, who was the last judge, became the first prophet. And there's this transition where these prophets come on to the scene. And the people, just at that time, the people began to ask for their own king, that they wanted something bigger than the judges. And in fact, because of Samuel, they thought his kids were kind of sketchy. So they said, for sure we want a king because we don't like your kids. And God said, well, I think that's a bad idea. I should be in charge. And they said, no, we want a king. And he said, fine. So make yourself a king. And so they brought in a king, and then things started to go sideways for them. There was civil war, so the kingdom was divided in half. The northern kingdom was 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom, Judah, was 2 tribes. And as you read through this account, the northern tribe, which is called Israel, had no good kings at all. The southern tribe had a few, but not many. And eventually, the northern kingdom was invaded by the Assyrians and just destroyed, and that people group was, those people were assimilated into the Assyrian culture. The southern kingdom was overrun by the Babylonians, and instead of them just decimating the southern tribe, they were taken into captivity and exile, and spent their time away from what they understood to be their homeland. And then there was another changeover of powers, and under the Persian rule, they were allowed to come back to their homeland and to rebuild. And so even though they were back in their homeland, they still were under this domination of the Persians. But there's this beginning during this time of this intense hope for a Messiah, because they had been promised a Messiah that would come to free him from this kind of captivity. And then through the working of Alexander the Great, the Greeks took over and overthrew the Persians. Alexander the Great died prematurely. His kingdom was divided into 4. The kingdom of Israel kind of bounced back and forth in a ping pong ball kind of fashion. And then the Romans came in, and I'm just going to abbreviate. The Romans came in, and then came Jesus. There's more to it a little bit, but there's a moment where, under the Maccabean time, where they actually revolted against the Greeks, and for a brief moment won their independence and thought, hey, the Messiah is coming now for sure, and then that toppled over, and they were overrun by the Romans. And so you had these different people all trying to figure out why this was happening, how it was happening, what would bring in the Messiah, what should they do to help usher in the Messiah. And so there were different views of who the Messiah would be, what it would be like, and they were expressed in these different Jewish sects. And that's a hard word to say, S-E-C-T-S. So just if you thought I said Jewish sects, it's sects, so just so we're clear. And so there was these varieties of opinions. So some I have just called them the collaborators, kind of like the tax collectors or the what they were called, the Herodians. And these were these people who kind of almost functioned like a political party, and they would pay homage to the sovereign ruler as a way to get favors and friendship to gain some kind of advantage. Then there were some people who had kind of given up waiting for the Messiah and decided they would take things in their own hand, and these were the Zealots. So they were opposed to any kind of payment of tribute by the Jewish people, the Israelites, to any kind of pagan emperor. They thought it to be treason to God, and so they would kind of promote violent uprising and revolts. They were assassins. They carried daggers. They were trying to overthrow things and usher in the Messiah that way. Then there were some people who thought that holy living would be the answer to bring in the Messiah. And some of these people might be seen as the Pharisees. They were separatists. Opposed to violence, they believed that salvation came from God, and that the reason for the delay of the Messiah was because of unholy living. And so they committed themselves to obeying God and to really trying to create this way that all people would obey God, that they would be fundamentally attached to the law, that they would keep it religiously and accurately as close as they could in response to obedience to God's law. And they thought if they did this, then the Messiah would come. And the Sadducees were also part of this camp, but they were even more letter of the law, more severe than the Pharisees. There was also some who didn't really buy the revolting, the idea of the zealots of revolt, and they thought that was kind of impossible. And they didn't really want to associate with the Roman culture, and they kind of couldn't quite see eye to eye with the Pharisees or Sadducees, and so they kind of thought they would just live separately. These were the Essenes. And so they would live in these alternative communities in a monastic kind of way, simple, devoted to prayer and study, and kind of away from things. So here's this kind of milieu that you see as Jesus comes onto the scene. Now, all of these groups, although they couldn't agree on how the Messiah would come or how it would all look, they could agree on some basic principles that when the Messiah came, there would be a proper and full return from exile, and there would be a rebuilding of the temple and a defeat of Israel's enemies. But they couldn't agree on the methodology. And so each faction was convinced that they had the right idea of who would be the Messiah and how he would arrive. And so they worked at kind of oppressing each other. And so when Jesus comes and begins talking about the kingdom of God and calling himself the Messiah, everyone kind of becomes frustrated because he doesn't really represent any one of these ideas. In fact, he begins to draw on ideas that offend all of them. And so as we look at this beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, as it's titled in the reading, the Beatitudes, Jesus shows up, and one of the first thing that comes out of his mouth is, God blesses those who are poor and realize their needs for him. God blesses the poor in spirit. And this is kind of like Jesus coming on and just kicking everything over. It creates this mess because it goes against everybody's way of thinking. That what Jesus is really saying at some level is that all of you who think you're in are not in, and all of you who think that you're not in or don't deserve to be in, you're in. So that would be like sinners and prostitutes and so on. So this was kind of a gigantic mess. Now, if you flip over, if you want to, in Luke, you have the same kind of telling of these Beatitudes, but with a slightly different angle, because, of course, it's a different writer, and he has his own way of wanting to approach things. But this is what he writes in the same Beatitudes. God blesses you who are poor, for the kingdom of God is yours. And then, as you flip down, he kind of gives you the opposite of that. He says, what sorrow awaits for you who are rich, for you only have your happiness now. And so you have this real dichotomy about needing to reimagine and rethink what exactly the Messiah was going to look like. What exactly was the Messiah going to be about? And they actually weren't really prepared to do that. They wanted to just, as we know, get rid of Jesus. And so as we see this, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It's it feels like a more natural reading. I appreciate what they're trying to do and giving us some insight, but blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And in this statement, Jesus is favoring the poor in spirit, which is not the religious, not the devout, not the pious, or even the spiritual. Or if we were to kind of think of this in a contemporary fashion, it's not the pastors or the elders or even church members who serve in soup kitchens. It's somebody different. No, this is about God favoring the ones who have come to be served at the soup kitchen. They are not the ones with something to give, but rather they are the ones with something to receive. They are blessed by God, spiritually speaking, because they are completely destitute and needy and aware of that. There's a pastor named Jarrett Banks, and he writes this about, in reflection on these Beatitudes, and specifically about the poor in spirit. He says this, Jesus spoke less about sin and more about our inability to see. Jesus said, "I came into this world for judgment, so that those who do not see may see." And then as you read through the Gospels, he says, you will continue to bump into this idea. "Do you have eyes and fail to see?" Jesus asked. "Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye instead of what's in your own eye? Blessed are the eyes that see what you see. Prophets and kings desired to see what you see, but did not see it." Over and over, Jesus talked about the importance of seeing something that most have difficult seeing. And he writes, "I believe this is what Jesus meant when he said that he came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. Not to get rid of it, but to bring it back into focus, to help us to truly see the purpose within it. This is why I believe Jesus said this, 'I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light.' To see anything, light is needed. Thus, one of the main purposes of Jesus is enabling people to see the real world and to see reality. And what is reality? What is it that we have so much trouble seeing? What is it that God wants us to see? I believe the answer is in Jesus' first recorded sermon. Jesus went up on the mountain. After he sat down and his disciples came to him, he taught them, saying, 'Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.'" This is a huge statement, and it's going to take us a while to grapple with this. Because I think that Jesus spends a lot of time asking us, to reimagine what is wealth and what is poverty. Jesus' example of these things, how to live and how to approach these things, is built entirely on a set of values and principles and objectives than we are accustomed to encountering in our society. The things that we traditionally avoid or despise, things that we name weak or powerless, are held up by Jesus as being the benchmarks to live by. Frederick Buechner, in reflecting on this, writes this: "If we didn't already know, but were asked to guess the kind of people Jesus would pick out for special commendation, we might be tempted to guess one sort or another of a spiritual hero. Men and women of impeccable credentials morally, spiritually, humanly, in every which way. If so, we would be wrong. Maybe those aren't the ones he picked out because he felt they didn't need the shot in the arm his commendation would give them. Maybe they're not the ones he picked out because he didn't happen to know any." That's such a great line. "He didn't happen to know any." That's like, oh, thank you, Frederick. But be that as it may, it's worth noting the ones he did pick out. Not spiritual giants, but the poor in spirit, as he called them. The ones who, spiritually speaking, have absolutely nothing to give and absolutely everything to receive. Like the prodigal son telling his father, "I'm not worthy to be called your son," only to discover for the first time at all of what it means to have a father. And I was reminded as I was thinking about this about Isaiah 55. And there's that kind of, we've talked about it at Lent several times, but there's that kind of puzzling beginning to that where the prophet writes, "Come all you who are thirsty, come to the waters. All you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread, and your labor on what does not satisfy? Listen to me and eat what is good, and you will delight in the richest of fare." So this is an interesting thing that the invitation is to come and to receive, but it's to come empty and without anything. Come and receive, those of you who have no money. That's a redefinition, a reimagining of poverty, of poorness. And I think several years ago, as I recall, Beth and I worked a teaching around this, and I remember Beth reflecting on, and sorry, Beth, it just happens that you're here. It's kind of funny. But we asked the question, what is God's expectation as we come? What is the catch in all this? What does it mean to come without money and to buy and to spend things on that we don't have, on what's bread? And this is what Beth said: "Come means come to receive, but only if you are incredibly thirsty." So there's this requirement to be thirsty. Buy something, but only if you have $0. Eat, but only if you leave behind the things that don't satisfy. Listen, but only if you are desperate to live. I think this is capturing a picture of what it means to be poor in spirit, because all of this requires a poverty of spirit. If we come back to this idea of boxes, of needing to break down boxes, there's this moment in which we have to let go and give up control to receive Christ. So receiving from Christ requires us letting go. And I think sometimes in my own life, there's certain things that hinder that process. Sometimes it's my own pride because I want things a certain way. Or sometimes it's even a fear of what I'm going to have to give up. What am I going to have to lose in order to let Christ in? Or maybe it means I have to let go of my own agenda, what I want him to be about, what I want him to say, what I want him to let me do. But receiving Christ, being poor in spirit, requires us letting Jesus deconstruct the boxes we try to keep him in. It requires us letting Christ deconstruct the boxes that we try to keep others in. In the ways we try to make Jesus speak for us, or make us feel good about ourselves, or how we try and make Jesus safe or comfortable. And in the end, being poor in spirit moves against this idea of us trying to establish our identity in a framework. Rather, being poor in spirit is about establishing our identity in Christ. Being open to experiencing God outside of our comfort zones. Allowing others freedom to operate out of their giftedness. Inviting others to discover God, not the box that we keep them in. I think one of the best ways to stay in touch with this idea of the call that Jesus wants us to come, recognizing that we have nothing that we on ourselves can earn or make it seem like we deserve what he wants to give. That tends to get in the way. When we say that we deserve, when there's a certain arrogance that we have things figured out, or that our way is the way, that's when we bump into this problem where Jesus is saying, no, that's not living out being poor in spirit. Being poor in spirit flows out of this idea of posture. And this word, poor, is all about posture, that it's not just about simply having no money, but it's in how one approaches God, and about how one comes, understanding that you're living in this landscape of grace. And the table is, I think, that example for us. It's that invitation to come and to eat, to empty out our pockets, and to come just with our souls open to receive, to let God feed us, to let God nourish us. And as we work at letting Jesus shape our lives, shape our identities, we begin to take on his nature. We begin to reflect who he is. And that same way as we come, this coming, this taking in, that we receive who Jesus is, that then we are to be that for those we come in contact with. That it's a reciprocal nature, that as we come and receive, that then we are to become that for others. So it doesn't work for us to want to receive, but not to bestow that on the way we see others, on the way we treat others. And so the way we kind of work this, there'll be an opportunity for you to come. You come when you feel ready. Our tradition is we tear off a piece of the bread and we dip it in the juice. The bread is gluten-free and lactose-free. It's kind of as free from stuff as we could make it so that everybody can pour break off bread and it could actually still be bread. But it's really the picture of what Jesus is offering you, to come with empty pockets, to receive, to be filled, so that we can be blessed, so that we can receive this kingdom and represent this kingdom in an accurate fashion.